you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, one of America's leading public intellectuals. Hill is currently the host of BET News and a political contributor for CNN. He's also the Steve Charles Professor of Media, Cities, and Solutions at Temple University in Philadelphia. Since his days as a youth in that same city, Mark Lamont Hill has been a social justice activist and organizer. Ebony Magazine has named him one of America's 100 most influential black leaders, and Hill is the author or co-author of four books: the award-winning Beats, Rhymes, and Classroom Life, Hip-Hop Pedagogy and the Politics of Identity, The Classroom and the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America, the New York Times bestseller Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond, as well as Gentrifier. Trained as an anthropologist of education, Dr. Hill holds a PhD with distinction from the University of Pennsylvania. And I'll be back with my conversation with Mark Lamont Hill in just a few minutes. So if you really want to understand this thing that we call white privilege, and which I realize so oftentimes people have a hard time with as a term, you really don't need to look a lot further than the way in which the media and commentators within it have addressed or failed to address, spoken about or failed to speak about the Austin bomber. This young man, 23 years old, who over the course of a 3-week period planted three bombs on the doorsteps of folks in East Austin, Texas, that is the part of Austin disproportionately black and Latinx folks, then proceeded to plant another explosive on the southwest side of the city in a more white and affluent area that was tripped by a tripwire as people walked by, then another explosive that he tried to deliver through FedEx. It exploded at a FedEx facility, and then ultimately a bomb that exploded while he was in the car with it, killing himself as the authorities were closing in on him. And once we knew the identity of the individual, who is white, he is male, he is Christian, and by that I mean a fundamentalist Christian, raised in a very devoutly religious home. He was homeschooled. He was part of a semi-survivalist Christian organization that did gun training, and they talked about various chemicals, according to other members of the organization, that could be used for explosive purposes. I mean, this was sort of a pseudo, you know, militia-type survivalist Christian family. Very devout, none of which is, you know, necessarily in and of itself problematic, but I think you know where I'm headed with this. If this young man who planted these bombs killed two people, seriously injured several others, had he been not a white person, but a person of color, had he been Muslim, and especially had he been Muslim, raised in a fundamentalist Muslim household where his family involved him in, enrolled him in, participated in survivalist training, specifically for Muslims, where they got weapons training, etc. I think you know full well, I think anyone being remotely honest does, that the comments would have been very different, that the speed with which we have dismissed the possibility that this could be a terrorist would have been far slower. We would have been much more willing to call it that, unlike the current situation where everyone has rushed to say, law enforcement first and foremost, that there is no evidence of this being terrorism. Sarah Huckabee Sanders the other day, of course, when this was all still going on before the identity of the bomber had been revealed and before he committed suicide as the cops were closing in, said from the podium during her press conference that there was no known tie to terrorism. Of course, really what she meant was there's no evidence this guy's a Muslim, because you can't say that there's no known tie to terrorism in general when you don't even know who the person is yet. What you're saying is we don't have any evidence that this guy's ISIS, that this guy's a Muslim, and there was no reason to believe that he was. So when she said there was no reason to think that, it was because of his identity, or what they suspected his identity to be. I think we all know that if there was any reason to believe that this kid, this young man, was Muslim, she probably wouldn't have said that. They would have said, well, we're looking at all the information. That's what they do whenever a Muslim acts out and kills people, whether it's Omar Mateen at the Pulse nightclub or that guy who ran over the bikers in New York City several months back, right? It's always that we're very quick to ascribe terrorist motives in those cases. But in this case, we've said it's not terrorism. And if you look at the media headlines and the way people have talked about it, law enforcement actually came out and said they looked at his confession video that I guess was on his phone. It's a 20-minute video. And they said he's a very disturbed young man talking about the challenges that he was experiencing in life. And I have no reason to think that law enforcement is misrepresenting the contents of that confession, though I do think the public has a right to see that confession. The victims' families have the right to see what was going through the mind of this individual who killed their loved ones or injured their loved ones. I assume they're representing it correctly, and I'm more than willing to accept the idea that this young man wasn't necessarily acting on the basis of any political agenda, even though he had posted a few things on the internet where he called himself conservative, talked about being against abortion, talked about being against gay marriage, etc. But, you know, it's certainly the case that he wasn't prolific on social media or the internet. He doesn't seem to have been, at least publicly, driven by a particular agenda. And so for the sake of argument, I am more than willing to say, you know what, maybe this guy wasn't acting out of political motivation. Maybe he wasn't acting out of some fundamentalist Christian survivalist motivation. That's entirely possible. What I do wish is that we could be as willing to engage that kind of forbearance when the doer of the deed is a person of color or when they are Muslim. Because, you know, people of color and Muslim folks also, quote unquote, face challenges and are disturbed about the direction of their life. That's what we keep saying for this young man. And it may very well be true. But if facing challenges in life were the reason why someone goes and builds 6 or 7 bombs and kills a couple of people, trying to kill as many as he could in that 3-week, roughly, span, 3.5-week span, if facing challenges were enough to make you do that, Black and brown folks would literally be setting off bombs every couple of minutes in this country. Women, as women, dealing with sexism and misogyny and abuse in the workplace and rape culture, they would be building bombs and setting them off every couple of minutes. LGBTQ folks would be doing the same thing. Poor people of all colors would be doing that, including a lot of poor white folks who were certainly facing challenges in life. Muslim folk would be doing that every few minutes, and they're not. The people who were doing that kind of thing disproportionately, according to the evidence, are white, and they are male, and they are at least nominally Christian. So even if their Christianity is not implicated in the crime, and even if their politics are not implicated in the crime, the point is when they are people of color and Muslims, we assume that their identity is central to the crime. So it's the double standard that we need to be concerned about. It's the double standard that says when a white terrorist or bomber or mass murderer or criminal of any kind, really, does something that's just inconceivable in terms of the horrific nature of it, we look for these excuses. What are they experiencing in life? or we talk about mental illness. And listen, it is entirely possible that this young man has or had various forms of mental illness. Those kids that shot up and bombed Columbine High School back in 99, they clearly were suffering from emotional or mental disorders of some form or another. So we can absolutely agree that in most cases, mass murderers, spree killers, snipers, bombers probably do suffer from some kind of mental or emotional dysfunction or malady. But again, the double standard is that we never extend that possibility to a person of color or someone who's Muslim who does that kind of thing. I mean, we don't assume for one second that mental illness is what drove Omar Mateen or drove the two Muslim shooters in San Bernardino a couple years back. Or, you know, that might be what has driven various quote-unquote Muslim terrorists. It's as if Muslims are not allowed the luxury of mental illness. We always assume it's ideology. We always assume it's the faith itself. If black folks do stuff, we don't talk about mental illness. In the case of the guy in Dallas a year and a half ago, whatever it was, who killed the five officers there on that shooting spree in downtown, nobody was talking about mental illness to any real extent in that case. What were they talking about? They were talking about how this guy was acting on behalf of Black Lives Matter. He wasn't even involved in Black Lives Matter, but he was black and he was shooting police. And so therefore, there was an assumption that there was an ideological motivation. That's the problem here. It isn't that we necessarily insist on making this young man in Austin into some type of Christian right-wing terrorist. It's just that I think we all know full well that if this were a person of color or a Muslim, they on the right would be turning him into a liberal or left-wing terrorist or whatever. And, you know, it's entirely possible that he wasn't acting on the basis of that, just like it's entirely possible that when people of color kill folks, they're not either. And so we go out of our way to make excuses or simply to humanize guys like the Austin bomber, right? Even talking about the challenges he faced in life, which again, I don't think that's a bad idea. I'm not saying don't humanize this guy. I think it is important, even for the worst of the worst, to understand who they are at a deep and multidimensional level. I don't believe anyone is one-dimensional, and I don't believe that anyone is only the worst thing that they ever did. I do want to understand what motivates terrorists and bombers and snipers and school shooters and gang members. I mean, I want to understand all of it because it's important that we understand the psychology of and the mentality of and the thinking patterns of people who engage in that kind of injurious behavior. But we don't try to humanize people of color in those situations. We don't really want to know, for instance, anything about Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker on 9/11. No one really gives a shit about that. Nobody's really interested in how Omar Mateen came to the Pulse nightclub and for what reasons and how did he get to a point where killing all those folks was in his mind justified. But we do want to understand that, don't we, when it's Stephen Paddock firing out the window of the hotel in Las Vegas at a crowd of country music revelers. We want to understand what in the world. And so we try to figure out, you know, what's the deal with Stephen Paddock and all these folks psychoanalyzing him. But when it's a person of color, we just don't. In fact, oftentimes, we will be quicker to humanize white murderers, including ones who are clearly acting on the basis of hateful terrorist motivation. We humanize them more quickly than we humanize black and brown victims of violence. You know, you look at the way that Trayvon Martin was talked about after he was killed by George Zimmerman. And there was, you know, we wanted to know how much weed had he smoked. He'd been suspended from school. All of these things, it really didn't have anything to do with the interaction that he had with George Zimmerman and Zimmerman killing him. None of that stuff had any bearing on that, had any relevance on that. But that was the way we talked about Trayvon in the press. We did the same thing with Freddie Gray, who was killed by police in Baltimore. Did the same thing with Tamir Rice. Here's a 12-year-old boy shot in a park in Cleveland by a cop who rolls up on him, sees him playing with a toy gun, does not give him any time or warning as he claimed to have done, but we have video evidence that shows the cop was lying. He then proceeds to shoot and kill Tamir Rice. And within days, the media in Cleveland is doing stories about not Tamir Rice's criminal history, because he didn't have one, but doing stories about Tamir Rice's family and some minor misdemeanor type shit that they had gotten involved in. When Eric Garner was choked out on the streets of Staten Island, same thing. We're going back and looking at all this real, you know, petty bullshit that he had gotten in trouble for mostly. Whereas when Dylann Roof goes into Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and kills, 13 people in a prayer group, we want to understand what motivated him. So we're going back over his internet, and we're looking at the motivation. And then, of course, they're going and taking him to, what was it, Burger King or McDonald's or Taco Bell, whatever the hell, went and got him, I think it was a burger, on the way after they'd arrested him, on the way to jail. You hungry? Yeah, I'm hungry. You want fries with that? Right? So we humanize white killers more quickly than we humanize black victims, always looking to dig up the dirt on black and brown victims, let alone on black or brown perpetrators. But with white perps, that isn't what we do at all. That's white privilege. It's white privilege on a couple of levels. The biggest level is it's the privilege of never being assumed to be a representative of your group. So when a white person commits some type of horrific over-the-top crime, whether it's a terrorist incident, a school shooting, or just some horrible, you know, sexually sadistic murder or serial killing, no one assumes in law enforcement, for instance, that we therefore need to be profiling white people for these things or on the lookout for white people for these things, you know, routinely stopping and frisking white people for these things. Same thing with Wall Street criminals, right? They were rich and they were white and they were overwhelmingly men, but we're not stopping rich white dudes driving around in nice cars, searching the trunk for evidence of, you know, some type of financial crime, even though, you know, you could make an argument, I guess. I'm not advocating it, but I'm saying those stops and those frisks and those searches would be every bit as legitimate statistically as the stops and the searches and the frisks that they do on people of color in the streets of New York under stop and frisk for several years until the court stopped that practice, at least in theory. So we just have a differential level of treatment, and that's about privilege. It's the privilege of never having, no matter what a white person does, never having to worry that I, as a white person, am going to have to answer for that or be blamed for that or be looked at as just like that. But that's something people of color do worry about. It's something that religious minorities do worry about, that Christians don't have to worry about. So that's Christian privilege as well. And then the second level of privilege is the way in which we are so much quicker to protect even the worst of these white folks in our community by giving them these, not outs, because these folks are being arrested and, you know, they're being prosecuted, but there's still a privilege of the way that you're represented in the media. There's still a better level of representation than when a person of color does the same thing. So on two different levels, that really is about the privileging of dominant group status and the privilege, I guess, above all else, of being seen as a multidimensional human being and the community from which you come being seen as multidimensional, as opposed to looking at it through a very one-dimensional lens. So see, sometimes privilege isn't about money and it isn't about power. At least not all the time. It's about being able to go through life with one less thing on your mind. And in this case, the one less thing that we as white folks get to have on our mind is the fear that we are going to be seen as the worst from our community. It'd be very nice if black folks could do the same. It'd be very nice if Latinx folks could do the same. It'd be very nice if Muslim folk didn't have to worry about that, but they do. And so long as they do, we have to continue to fight for justice, for equity, and for fair treatment across the board. Be back in just a minute with the program. Stick with me. Mark, thanks so much, man, for taking the time to be on the program. I always like asking folks to tell a little bit about who they are, but not in the formal sense, a little bit of backstory, because I think sometimes when people like yourself, and this goes for me as well, when we pop up on folks' TV screens at night, sometimes I think there is an assumption about the path that they took to get where they are, and we sort of think we know people, but we don't necessarily really know sort of the backstory. And sometimes I think getting a little backstory is helpful, A, because it helps all of us stay a little humble about how we got from point A to point B, which is critical in a society that tells us if if we've made something of ourselves, it's because we're the best, you know, and if we haven't, it's because we're not worth anything, which is a horribly problematic mentality that we need to push back against. But also because I think for people listening, they need to also understand the complexity of all the characters and folks that they meet in the world and the people that they see as scholars and pundits and intellectuals. So tell folks a little bit briefly about how you came to be the Mark Lamont Hill that we see on CNN or that we used to see sparring with Bill O'Reilly. I'm glad you don't have to mess with that nonsense anymore. Although I do appreciate the one time you were on there and defended me by name to him when he attacked me. So I do appreciate that. But give us a brief rundown of how you came to be this public intellectual that we see today, because I take it from your background, that was not always a given.
No, it was not, man. You know, I didn't grow up, you know, thinking I was going to be a public intellectual. I have the extraordinary privilege of thinking and reading and writing for a living. I mean, that I always say that the idea of being able to do what you love for a living, first of all, is an extraordinary privilege and a very class driven privilege. And the ability to think about a life of the mind in the way that I've been able to live is something that I didn't anticipate because I didn't grow up around that. I didn't see people doing that. You know, I grew up in North Philadelphia for the first half of my life, and it was a tough neighborhood. A lot of poverty, a lot of violence, and it's beautiful people there, wonderful people there. You know, I learned the beauty of Black people there and the beauty of community, but I didn't necessarily have access to the kind of intellectual life that I was going to have later on in life. But I went through it. I mean, I was fortunate enough to have parents who were teachers. And so in a lot of ways, we stayed in a neighborhood we didn't need to stay in because they had a certain kind of commitment to community and to Black folk. And they didn't want to move to a fancy middle class neighborhood. And so I saw the gamut. You know, while I didn't grow up with that in mind, I did grow up as a reader. And so I would always read books and try to imagine a life outside of what I was experiencing. And I read all kinds of stuff, man, as a kid, from Dick and Jane books to Judy Blume, all the way up to wrestling magazines. But it wasn't until ninth grade that I read Malcolm X. And when I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, it really changed my life. And I haven't been the same since. My life hasn't been the same since. I understood the world in different terms after reading Malcolm, but I still wasn't necessarily performing in school the way people think, you know, intellectuals always did. Basketball was my primary concern. I was concerned with being an athlete. I played basketball in high school. I turned down. My parents wouldn't let me take basketball scholarships, so I went over to Morehouse to walk onto the team. And it was very much a life of basketball. And then when basketball ended, I didn't know what to do. I dropped out of Morehouse. I was homeless for a while. I was doing all kinds of wild stuff out in them streets. And it really took a minute for me to recalibrate and realize that I had the possibility to do all sorts of stuff. And it was when I dropped out that I thought back to my freshman year at Morehouse when I saw Michael Eric Dyson speak at our Crown Forum lecture. And that was the first time that I saw somebody do what I thought I wanted to do. And that was use a PhD to help somebody, to make the world better than I found it. And then I started the journey of struggling and writing to be an academic. And then I saw people like you. I saw people like Cornell. I saw a range of people who decided that they weren't just going to talk to small audiences, but they wanted to bring some interesting ideas to the broader public. And so folk like Cornell West were academics speaking to broader publics. Folk like you and Barbara Ehrenreich and others were people who were operating outside the academy, but informing our ideas inside of it. And I said, I want to be like y'all, man. Yeah. And I kept struggling and kept writing. And that's how I've gotten where I am today, which I think is a trained academic, but really someone who wants to be an intellectual, someone who's committed to being an activist, and somebody who wants to leave the world better than he found it.
What I think is so important about that story, two things. One is obviously that perseverance and sticking to what you really care about are critical things that we all, if we can get to do that, it's a huge privilege and it's something we wish for everyone. I mean, we wish that everyone has the capacity to be able to follow their dreams and do the stuff that they really believe in and care about deeply. And it's a struggle to get there. It's not an easy path. And then secondly, the piece about having parents and folks who in effect were mentors who were able to be in your life in a way that pushed you in an intellectual direction, even if it wasn't always foreseen as an academic direction. And sometimes, you know, I think we forget about that because we do live in this country that says, you know, you can be anything if you just try hard. And on the one hand, you know, your story is partly about that, but it's not really, just like none of our stories are. It's also about having the right people come into your life at the right time, the right book, reading Malcolm, you know, the right teachers or Michael Eric Dyson speaking at Morehouse or your parents being teachers. Like any of those things don't happen. And all of your brilliance won't necessarily bring you to where you are right now. And I think that's vital for people to acknowledge.
No, I was just going to say, I agree, man. You know, growing up, it wasn't like I grew up as the smartest kid in my clique. You know, like there were people who were just as smart as I was, who are just as smart as I am. I only say were because many of them have passed. And the only difference between me and them was the opportunity. I got put on a school bus to go to the Northeast of Philadelphia, which wasn't a fancy school. It wasn't brilliant up there, but it was a white working class neighborhood. So they had teachers and books and the school was safe. And my friends had to go to neighborhood school where sometimes they didn't have access to those things. They weren't any less smart or talented. Right. Their aspirations weren't any lower.
Right.
They just had the same opportunity. And when I was in the street and you know, after I dropped out, a lot of the differences really was just luck and me getting caught at the right time and me not getting caught at the right time and other people not having the same luck, man. And so I never, ever, ever want people to think, you know, that I somehow worked harder than everybody else or was more disciplined than everybody else or better behaved than everybody else. I grew, you know, my brother grew up in the same house and spent most of my adult life in prison. And it wasn't because he was necessarily a terrible person. He wasn't. He's a very good person. But in some ways, school couldn't recognize his gifts in a way that it could mine.
Right.
So it's not even a question of parenting. You know, the right always tries to say, well, if the parents just do what they're supposed to do, it's not that simple. Life isn't that simple, man. It's as you know, it's about structures. It's about resources. And some of it is just good luck.
Right. And I think if we don't tell those stories, we end up feeding that dominant narrative, which reinforces all the rationalizations for inequality. Because, you know, if you actually do think that where folks end up is all about them, then you can easily shit on people at the bottom and you can lavish gifts and tax cuts and subsidies on the rich because you assume that they're just simply better people. So that's why I wanted to start there, because I feel like if we can all start to be more honest and more humble about how we actually got from point A to point B, then we reinforce the idea that we have to be that luck for somebody else. You know, we have to be that person who is that mentor for somebody else because we had that. And so it becomes an issue of reciprocity and an issue of justice, you know, at the same time. So moving from the personal now to the larger political perspective, let's just start that piece by me asking you, give me sort of a bad news, good news picture of America right now as you see it. We'll start with the bad. I mean, I think some of it's rather obvious, but give me your take on where we are that scares you and where we are that inspires you right now.
You know, I'm watching a Trump administration dismantle so much of the progress that has been made in the previous decades. And I'm not one of those people that romanticizes American progress, that fetishizes it or that overstates it. We got a long way to go. I was critical of the Obama administration as much as anybody, and Bush and Clinton. But there are certain basic things we could talk about, like, for example, trans rights, transgender soldiers serving in the military, just as a concrete example, as something that's being dismantled. Environmental protections being dismantled. The nuclear deal with Iran dismantled. Just as three concrete examples of things that are being undone. And when I watch those things, some of it is just the normal ebb and flow of politics in America. You know, two steps forward, one step back. But this is absurd even for those who are on the right. Trump isn't simply an extreme version of a conservative or Republican president. He is of a different sort altogether. When George Bush won't stand next to you, when the Bush family won't stand next to you, when they take the moral high ground, and even the intellectual high ground, you with some low cotton, as they say. So for me, that's incredibly scary to watch a president who doesn't seem to have a rational handle on the world. It doesn't scare me that Trump has a bad worldview. What scares me is that President Trump does not have a worldview. He is not somebody who said, I'm going to change the world. He was someone who was obsessed with running the world. He is fueled largely by ego and by a wildly unhealthy narcissism that will allow him to throw people away who offer him critique and pull closer to him people who tell him exactly what he wants to hear, which is that he's wonderful, he's beautiful, he's right, he's a genius. And so what you end up seeing is a Trump administration that is like musical chairs. And the only people who remain sitting are people who are willing to allow him to become more militaristic, more anti-poor, more trans and homophobic, more anti-black, more anti-immigrant than anyone we've seen in the modern era, certainly in the extreme modern era, in the late modern era. So for me, it's incredibly scary to see that. I guess the good news is that we are in a moment of extraordinary resistance. In 2014, I watched young people resist in Ferguson. I was on the ground in Ferguson, and I watched people resist. I watched people organize. I watched people enter that new moment of kind of radical activism. And then I left Ferguson and went to New York, and then I went to L.A., and then I went to Baltimore. I stayed in my home city of Philadelphia, and I watched people fight and resist and organize. And then I went to Palestine. I went to the West Bank, and I watched not just resistance, but I watched him, and this is what was exciting for me, the synergy in the conversation between the kids in Ferguson and the kids in the West Bank, and the kids in Gaza and the kids in Ferguson. And when I watched that synergy and I watched the kind of international resistance to white supremacy, to state violence, to capitalism, to settler colonialism, I said we might be onto something. And so despite how dark the moment is right now, and it is a dark moment, I've never been more inspired that we will win.
So what do you think it is about these mostly young people, whether we're talking about in the West Bank, whether we're talking about in Baltimore or Ferguson or in streets all around the country, in the Movement for Our Lives and, of course, the larger Black Lives Matter movement, the Dreamers, all of these young folks mostly who are leading so many of these movements both here and abroad? What is it about them today, or what is it about this particular generation and cadre of activists that seems to be so much more aware of the strategies that they need to be employing and so much more aware of the need to be linking up in this way? Because, you know, I come from a tradition where it was always about, unfortunately, throughout most of history, it seems like it's been activists and organizers, even when we were doing good work, who were fighting over turf a little bit. You know, it was like trying to get the attention for our movement and our struggle and our issue, and then not always working together and connecting. What is it about this group of folks, both here and abroad, that you think is, or do you think is different?
You know, I think there's some similarities. I think there's some differences. I'm starting to see in the last year or so the turf wars reemerge. I'm starting to see people battle over who is the real activist on the block, and I'm starting to see some organizational tensions. So we see some of that, right? But I think one of the things we also see with these young people, and this is key, is the ethic of risk. Yeah. And it's not the first time we've seen the ethic of risk. You know, Huey had the ethic of risk. Right. You know, Angela had the ethic of risk. Martin had the ethic of risk. But I think whenever you get a new generation of young people, there's a moment where they say we've had enough, whether it's in August of 55 with after Emmett Till. Emmett Till wasn't the first person to have that happen, the first person to be dragged and yeah. lynched, beaten. But there was a moment where we said enough. And the spectacle of Emmett Till and seeing that open casket did something to energize and mobilize a generation of young people who'd had enough. I think similarly, in the 90s, we saw it with Rodney King to some extent. And now we're seeing it again with this generation where we say, look, Mike Brown wasn't the first person to lay on the ground. Trayvon was on the ground. Hadiyah Pendleton was killed. You know, Sandra Bland was killed right after that. But there was something about the Mike Brown moment where the international spectacle of violence, where you saw his body out there for 4.5 hours, did something to mobilize and energize a group of young people who said, we've had enough. We've had enough of fighting when we see obvious injustice in the case of George Zimmerman killing Trayvon Martin, and you do nothing. We've had enough, and we're going to mobilize against state power nationally first and then internationally. That's a thing. And the ethic of risk is to say that we're not afraid. We're not afraid of losing our job yet. We're not afraid of losing some fancy title. We're not afraid of locking this up. We're not afraid of losing resources because y'all already took our resources. Y'all already oppress us. Y'all already gave us juvenile curfews. Y'all already stop and frisk us. You already do this stuff. So we ain't got nothing to be afraid of. And I watch these young people on the ground with that ethic of risk, that courage, and they haven't been spoiled yet by the trappings of power. I'm encouraged by it. You know, this is also a secular moment. Yeah. And so while the church is very much involved, because I think we overstate how much the church isn't involved, the church is very much involved in these actions.
Sure.
But the church isn't the center point of action. Mm-hmm. So when these preachers come stepping through, like, yo, y'all need to listen to us. They're like, nah, B, not like that. You know, you got civil rights leaders who would rather have organizations die. Yeah. With their arm wrapped around it and give it to a young person, you know, they're like, nah, this isn't going to work that way.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I think this generation, given just our cultural moment, is more inclusive. We're more inclusive. And again, there's still patriarchy. There's still misogyny. There's still deep homophobia and transphobia. I'm not saying there isn't. But there's at least an expressed commitment to having more diverse leadership and having more horizontal leadership. I think that has made this movement stronger. It's made it more expansive. So those kinds of things, I think, give us a different vantage point. Some of that is the moment. Some of that is the internet, the technology. Some of that is just who we are. And I couldn't be more excited about that part of where we are.
And then that raises the question, though, for those of us who are a little older, what is our role vis-a-vis these young people? Because I'm of the opinion every movement has to be led by young people. I mean, it was young people, really. You know, we think of the civil rights movement as old heads because you look at old black and white TV footage, everybody looks 50. You know, I mean, everybody looks older than they were. I remember looking at my parents' yearbook from high school, and I'm like, why are y'all 40 years old in high school? Because, you know, everybody looked older, right? And because they dressed a certain way, and they carried themselves a certain way, and they looked a certain way. But it was young people. I mean, the folks in SNCC were 19, 20, 21, 22 years old, you know? And so if we're going to, as older folks in the struggle, though, still be involved in it, what is our role vis-a-vis those young people? What role can we and should we be playing to help amplify their voices or make room for them?
I think the role of the elders is to whisper wise counsel. It's to offer people insight. So whenever I talk to young activists, I say, I want y'all to make some different mistakes. I don't expect y'all to not make mistakes. I just want y'all to make some different ones. Don't do what I did in 1996.
Right.
Because if you do that, then you have not learned from elders. You have not enjoyed the benefits of eldership, of having elders around you. So you're going to make mistakes as activists, but make some new ones. Listen to us. And it's our job to make sure that we offer them honest feedback. A lot of times we use history and age as a baton to beat over the heads of young people.
Right.
So all we tell them about is how old we were and how, you know, we did stuff back in the day and y'all not as disciplined as us and as focused as us. And not only is it not true, but it's unhelpful. Young people have to know that they don't have to be perfect to be useful. That comes from letting them know where we went wrong, where we made mistakes, we miscalculated. Another thing we have to do is be committed to mentoring young people. It's not enough to yell at them from the cheap seats. You know, we have to actually be on the ground and mentor them and work with them and train them. And training for leadership, though, means that we have to let them lead. Yeah. Again, I see too many organizations where the leader is 90 years old, 100 years old, 80 years old, and there's no assistant leader. You know, it's just them. And that can't happen. We absolutely need leadership to be willing to move out of the way. We need to know when to be quiet. Yep. And when let them speak, man. I mean, there was nothing more, again, inspiring than watching Reverend Sekou and Ferguson say, you know what, Cornell, and Cornell West said the same thing. You know, Cornell, we need to get off the stage and let these young people on, let these young sisters on, let these young brothers on. And because it's their moment, it's their time. We're here to help. We'll get arrested with you. We'll give you advice. We'll give critique, but we're going to move out the way.
Yeah. Well, going back to that issue of Ferguson and the post-Ferguson movement for Black Lives that is really, well, I mean, obviously it begins really after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, but really takes off, obviously, in the wake of the killing of Mike Brown. And that movement for the last several years has obviously been doing incredible work, branching into different areas, lots of attention for about 2.5 years on issues of police misconduct, lots of media attention of police shootings of often unarmed civilians, pretty much front page news. And lately, up until very recently, it had begun to fade a bit as far as attention paid to it, despite the fact that the number of those killings has remained pretty consistent over the past 4 years. Recently, we have a case out of Sacramento where Stephon Clark was killed in his grandmother's backyard holding a cell phone. You got into it the other night with a former officer from the LAPD on CNN who was, as is so often the case, seeking to rationalize this shooting. What I want to ask you about is not so much about the shooting itself, but I want to ask you this. It's a slightly different and I think deeper question. Why is it so difficult, in your estimation, for law enforcement or former law enforcement or white people more broadly to see the disproportionality here and to feel the pain that families feel and to understand how this constant repetition of the same talking points every time this happens re-victimizes entire communities? I mean, at some point when you make the same excuse, whether it's someone holding a gun or not, someone holding a toy gun like Tamir, or simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time like Ianna Stanley Jones or Akai Gurley or Rekia Boyd, or simply asking to be left alone like Eric Garner in Staten Island, you sort of lose credibility when it's the same rationalization every time. Why is it so hard for folks to just simply step back from any given incident and understand the way that these rationalizations re-victimize Black and brown peoples?
This will probably be my shortest answer. You know, white supremacy. It's interesting because the law, and I talk about this in my book, Nobody, right? Mm-hmm. That the part of what the law asks you to invoke as a jurist or as a juror, excuse me,
yeah,
is the reasonable man standard,
yeah,
right? Or now we'd say the reasonable person standard. What would a reasonable person do under the same circumstances? And with law enforcement, we even give them a wider threshold. We don't even ask what the reasonable person would do. We ask what the reasonable officer would do. And so it doesn't make a normative moral claim. We're not saying what's right or what's wrong. We're saying, what would a reasonable person do? Now, that doesn't seem like a bad idea, except that the seat of reason has been seen as not just the mind, but the white mind. and the white conscience and the white understanding. So every time someone sits in that jury box or in the court of public appeal, sitting on their couch at the crib, they're looking and they're asking themselves, what would a reasonable person do under these circumstances? And they're, again, they're not thinking about what would Eric Garner's cousin do or what would Mike Brown's brother do? Or they're thinking about what would the average white person do? And so when white people are looking at this, they say, well, shit, if I saw Trayvon Martin walking down the street, I'd be scared, too. But this is how they see us. Mm-hmm. So the problem is every time they look at a case like the case in Sacramento, they're saying, well, yeah, the kid was running. You know, what if he turned back around? Oh, they beat Rodney King within an inch of his life and all those cops. But if they had stopped beating him, he would have gotten up and ran through the neighborhood. Like, I mean, this is literally what the police argument was, right? And so because there's an unhealthy, irrational white supremacist fear of black bodies, our system normalizes that and through the law codifies that. So it's hard for white people to say enough already, because each time there's a new case, deep down they're saying, yeah. And the only time there's a rare exception is when it's something that's so egregious, so absurd. Like, for example, in Charleston, where the guy's running away and they plant a taser. And even then,
right.
You could still find 12 white people. Yeah. To be like, yeah, but.
Yeah, there's still a juror in that case who goes into deliberations and says, I will not under any circumstances find this man guilty.
Right.
I'm glad you brought up that reasonable person standard, because it's very interesting to me. We give police a wide berth using that standard, and yet we don't allow black folks the same standard for their behavior. So, for instance, well, why did he run? Why did he run? That shit is very reasonable from the perspective of a black person in this country who's being pursued by a cop. Similarly, when people say, well, why did he resist? Okay, first of all, it may not seem reasonable, and it may not be a good idea to resist an officer when they have their hands on you. But let's remember, we also are not always thinking, right? When someone puts their hands on us and has their arm around our neck or is in some way aggressing against us, we go back to lizard brain status. We don't think, oh, this is an officer of the law who I'm supposed to submit to. All you're thinking about is, I need to get your arm away from my neck. You're choking me to death, or you're hurting me. The idea that people can just go limp, you know, when they're being attacked is usually stuff that people say who've never been in a fight.
And who've never been arrested. Tim, I got a PhD. I got a fancy endowed chair at a university. I'm on TV. I ain't committed a crime in decades. And if the police came running at me right now with a gun, I'd run. I just would. And if you catch me, you catch me. But I could see that. And in the case of Sacramento, they didn't even announce themselves as police. Right. So I got two people at night running at me. And first of all, if you run from the police, the last place you run is your house if you committed a crime.
Right.
Like, there's so many things about this that don't make sense. Right. But again, the problem, I think, Tim, is actually that they do give black people the same standard. They invoke the same white man standard.
Yeah. So black folks and brown folks are not allowed to act reasonably. And you know what else they're not allowed? I thought of that this week. You know, we've just had this bomber in Austin who has finally, you know, blown himself up with his 7th bomb. White guy, a homeschooled fundamentalist Christian family, participated in gun training as part of some Christian survivalist group. And not only, of course, you know, have we not described him as a terrorist, people have gone out of their way to say that he's not, in ways that I think we all know, had he been raised in a fundamentalist Muslim home, trained on guns as part of a survivalist organization, we'd be having a very different conversation. But the thing I wanted to ask you about here, it seems like every time this happens, aside from the double standard on the terrorism label, the only people who are allowed the privilege of being mentally ill are white folks, right?
Yes.
Meaning, like, you know, I figure there are some black criminals and brown criminals and Muslim criminals and even quote-unquote terrorists who also have mental illness, but that's never allowed. That's never discussed. That it's always an ideological motive or a cultural motive. And it's like black and brown folks are not allowed the privilege of just having, you know, struggles. Like they said about this kid in Austin. Well, he's had some real struggles in life. You know, talk a little bit about that and the way that we come to these analyses so differently.
It's such a fascinating thing. I mean, I think some numbers estimate between 40 and 60% of people in prisons are suffering from some mental illness. 40 is the low number. And yet it's not like 40% of the time we're invoking mental illness to think about crime. Even if we just looked at like extreme crimes like murder and bombing and things like that, we don't normally do that. We weren't really looking at John Allen Muhammad's family records and mental health as an exculpatory practice. We weren't trying to figure out how the DC sniper was just a misguided kid who was led astray.
Right.
We don't use mental illness to make sense of black people. We use mental illness to make sense of white people, because with white people, we're always trying to humanize them. And with black and brown folk, we're always trying to demonize them. So when a white person blows up a building, we say, oh, well, we got to figure this out. I mean, how does a white guy go to blow up a building? I mean, he must have been led astray somewhere. Something must have happened in his life. He must have some kind of a trauma.
Yeah.
We need some kind of exculpatory practice so that he doesn't turn to be just a monster. And very rarely, very, very rarely do we not do that. With black folk, however, it's almost the opposite. The only time we go into their family history and their mental health and all that stuff is when they are the victims of a shooting.
Right.
When Trayvon Martin gets killed, then we want to know about his family life. We want to know if he smoked weed, as if that matters. With Mike Brown, we want to know what kind of kid he was and whether he shared his toys in kindergarten, because somehow that's going to give us some insight. But when it comes to black folk who commit crimes and even heinous crimes, we just say, well, that's what they do. They're monsters. They're animals. They're violent. Is another way, again, of normalizing whiteness and humanizing whiteness and demonizing and dehumanizing black and brown folk. And we see it in the media all the time, even when innocent children get killed. I mean, think about Sandy Hook shooting. I remember reading that I did a study as a researcher of the news accounts. And one of the most consistent phrases after the Sandy Hook shooting was, this shouldn't happen here. And I always ask, where the hell should this happen? I mean, where should kindergartners get killed? Where should anybody get killed? Right. Where should that happen? The word should, again, is an ethical and moral and normative claim about who deserves to live and who doesn't. And that, for me, is scary as hell when we normalize the idea that little white kids deserve protection and little black and brown people don't. This shouldn't happen anywhere.
Right. Well, and the irony of putting it that way, because that was, you know, something years ago after Columbine that I said, and after the school shooting outside of San Diego in 01, where it was the same thing being said, you know, this shouldn't happen here. And my point then, and I wasn't the only one making it, but you know, what we were trying to say was, you know, you all don't see the irony. When you say that, you are letting us know, not only is it a form of furthering white supremacy and also your class privilege to be so oblivious, but it actually, ironically, demonstrates how much danger you put yourself in. Because when you say that time after time after time, you're letting your guard down to the pathology and the dysfunction that indeed does exist in your community. When those kids at Columbine are building bombs in their basement and right. their parents don't have a clue, and the guy that sold them the material at the Ace Hardware was like, oh, this must be for a science fair. You know, some black kids roll up at Ace. I mean, really, some black kids roll up at Ace in Littleton, Colorado, looking for blasting caps and gunpowder, and somebody's getting a call. You know, somebody.
They're not even getting out the store.
No, not a chance.
Yeah, it is ironic. And, you know, there's such historical precedents for white people continuing to close ranks around whiteness in ways that operate against their interests, whether it's in the cases of violence from terrorists, or whether it's in terms of voting Trump or voting Bush or not quite wanting to end slavery. I mean, Du Bois was writing about this in 1935 in reference to the Reconstruction period, you know, and he said the psychic wages of whiteness were the thing that allowed the white worker to side with a planter and not the slave. The white worker just believed that whiteness would save them, and that whiteness was as others have said, like property. And when you think about whiteness as property, then you close ranks around it. You want to own it. You want to hold it, and it'll allow you to work against your own interests. And when you continue to normalize white people and humanize white people and not black people, you end up in places where you let white kids buy explosives, like you said, because they're like, oh, what could they possibly do with that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's a shame, and it's dangerous. And at some point, white folk have to wake up to it. I'm not optimistic that this will change, not just because of whiteness, but because of our obsession with guns. Our bizarre fetishization of guns and of the Second Amendment itself makes me think that, you know, we're not getting anywhere. I mean, kids die every year, every month at this point. And we do nothing. And we can look at so many other policies which continue to yield terrible outcomes for everyday folk. And I continue to watch everyday folk continue to vote for them, whether it's tax policy, whether it's foreign policy. I mean, you know, we continue to vote to destroy and plunder the Middle East and then wonder why we produce terrorism. But it doesn't change our foreign policy, right?
Right.
And we can go on and on down the list of all the things that operate against our interests. Yeah. So until we have a real movement that includes political education with our organizing, I don't see much of a change. But again, I'm optimistic that we will have that moment. I'm starting to see that more and more.
Yeah. Well, speaking of of some at least positive movement in the right direction. I want to ask you a little bit about, I know you obviously were, you know, you're born in Philadelphia, you're back there now at Temple, and I want to ask you two things about Philadelphia. Recently, the newly elected DA, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, announced that for the most part, he's just telling his deputies in the DA's office, we're just really not going to prosecute weed cases. We're just not. And there's been a lot of talk about how important it is that we have progressive-minded DAs who believe in restorative justice, who do not participate in this absurd war on drugs that has resulted in such mass incarceration disproportionately for black and brown bodies. How do you see that playing out? I mean, obviously, it's an important symbolic moment. Do you think it's also going to actually have real impact in that city and that it could be the kind of thing replicated elsewhere?
I do. I think that the right doesn't have feelings. Really, politicians in general don't have feelings. They have interests. And I think what we've seen in the last few years is people say, you know what, this mass incarceration thing, this drug thing, yeah, it's immoral and all that, yada, yada, yada. But more importantly, it's costing us too much money. And you're starting to see the power brokers on the right also say, hey, this mass incarceration thing needs to be reimagined, particularly around drugs. So I think you're going to see some pushback because of interest convergence.
Yeah,
I think that what Larry Krasner is doing here in Philadelphia is extraordinary. I was in the gym yesterday, actually, and I bumped into a friend from high school who's a cop. And he was like pissed. He's not a bad guy. He's just a cop, you know. And he thinks in that way. And he was just like, this is crazy. Like, you're making my job harder by not allowing me to lock people up for committing crimes. What I was trying to get him to think about was, well, why is this a crime, right? Let's take the law out of it for a minute. Why do you want to lock up somebody with a bag of weed in their pocket? Like, why would that be helpful to anybody? And to his credit, when pushed on it, he really didn't have an answer other than that's just what I've been trained to think. Part of what Larry Krasner is doing is helping those of us who have been part of the abolition movement, you know, challenge the world to think in ways that reflect excarceration, which is that this idea of not using the carceral state, not using the prison, as the resolution to social problems and social contradictions. So, yeah, I don't want people to I don't really care if people gamble too much, but I don't want people to gamble in ways that are irresponsible. I don't want people to use drugs in ways that are unhealthy. I don't want people to, I don't want sex work to exist. I don't look at it as a moral failure. I just don't think it's safe, particularly. Right. But I don't want people to go to jail for it. I don't want people to be a criminal for it. But because we've criminalized certain things, we have to actually decriminalize our minds and decriminalize our imaginations, as I talk about in my newest book, which I haven't finished yet, so that we can understand the world in different terms. And I think people like Larry Krasner, who just draw a hard red line and say, look, I'm not locking nobody up for no weed. This is stupid. It's a waste of resources, et cetera, will help shift the mindset. And when we see that crime doesn't radically go up because there's a bunch of people walking around with weed in their pocket unchecked, the horror, that no one else has to do it either. And so I think what Larry Krasner is doing is remarkable. Yeah. I think, and it's not just the drug thing, it's also getting rid of the bail system.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
80% of people who are in American jails are there because they don't have enough money to pay for bail. That means that we have essentially a debtor's jail, and that's immoral, that's evil. And so those kinds of changes get people out of prison, and they don't increase crime.
Before I ask you the last question about Philadelphia, talk a little bit about the book you're working on right now, because I didn't realize you were working on one. What is it? I mean, I know you said it's not done yet, but what are you looking at in that book?
I'm working on two projects. Three really, but the one that I was just referencing is called A Schooling Against the Prison. And what I'm trying to do is challenge people to imagine, to reimagine and rebuild schools in ways that don't reinforce the logic of prison, the imperatives of prison, or the pipeline to prison. I want us to change how we think. I want us to change what we read. I want to think how we do discipline. I want us to think how we structure the school, what the personnel looks like, what the built environment looks like. It's a small book, but the idea is that if I can talk to teachers early, if I can talk to principals early, I can get them to reimagine school so that it doesn't feel like a training ground for prison. And that's something that I don't even think think about, like, walking into a school, man, and there's schools in Philly where it takes you 15 minutes to get into the school because you got to go through a metal detector.
Right.
You got a video camera, parole officer, probation officer, school officer, locker search, you know, body search, book bag search. It takes you 15 minutes to get into the school. And then once you get in, nobody stops you from leaving.
Right.
Right. So there's all this infrastructure around the criminalization process and none around investing in you. So I want to dare people to imagine a school that is built on investment and love rather than containment and blame. And then very quickly, the other projects I'm working on, one is a small book on an anthology. It's actually not small, but it's a collection of writers, of black writers from 1948 until now, who have written about Palestine, because I want to reignite, or help reignite, and be part of that conversation of reigniting the relationships between blacks and Palestinians. And I want people to know that this ain't new, that, you know, even when we weren't doing it right, like Du Bois, you know, wasn't doing it right, but he was talking about Palestine. King, and I, you know, and obviously you've talked about this, and I actually was just reading about you yesterday, coincidentally, talking about this. We don't know exactly what King thought about it, because so many lies have been made about it on the question. But at the very least, we know that he may have been able to be moved on the question, had he lived longer. But then you got Huey, you got Angela, you got Malcolm. There's a long history of black internationalist struggle that I want to unpack and excavate. And then finally, you know, I'm doing a lot of work on Afro-Palestinians, and I'm doing a documentary on what it means to be black in Palestine. And I'm super excited about it. And I'm headed back there in a few weeks, and I'm there a lot. To do this work and to really help forge some international bonds.
Yeah, that is fascinating stuff. And when you get that together, I definitely want to have you back on to talk about it, because I think that's a really under-discussed aspect of that particular struggle. The other thing that you say you got three projects going, but I also know, and this is back to Philadelphia, so you just opened a bookstore, right?
Yeah, man.
So talk a little bit about why that was so important for you to do, why it was important to have not only a black owned bookstore, but a black bookstore, a space that is functionally black space. Obviously, it's for anyone, but it is very intentional. Why was that so important?
I'm so glad you made that distinction between a black owned bookstore and a black bookstore.
Yeah,
you know, because black folk have owned all kinds of fucked up shit. You know, for me, it was about how I grew up. You know, I told you I read Malcolm and it changed my life. After reading Malcolm, the next place I went was Hakeem's bookstore on 52nd Street. I went to the Gallery Mall in Philly across from the Cinnabon, and went to Horizon Books and and Basic Black Books. And I would hang out on the corners with old heads that were selling books. And for me, the community of a black bookstore wasn't just about a place where you could buy books. It was about having a community of people who could help me read through different literatures, who could give me keys, who could push me in a direction, who could challenge me, who could open me up to new literature. The black bookstore was a site, and has been a site, of political struggle, of political resistance since the 60s. So, and really before that, when you think about other kind of spaces of black literacy, whether it was the church, whether it was the makeshift black school in the Jim Crow era, we've always had spaces where black folk have used literacy to animate politics. And so for me, I wanted to create a space for that. The other thing was, in the era of, and I almost don't like to use this word because it's like a tick with academics, but in the neoliberal moment where market values prevail over everything, and where private becomes trumps the public good, and where efficiency becomes the way we measure everything, and it's a very narrow notion of efficiency, what we saw was bookstores shrink, because people say, well, why have a little bookstore if we can just buy the books at Barnes & Noble or B. Dalton in the 90s, right? The same way, why have a local hardware store if we could have a big True Value? And so we ended up seeing the mom and pops get swallowed up by these big ones, which may have carried some of our books, but still didn't have the culture and the community and the freedom around those things. And also, they didn't carry all the books. You couldn't walk into B. Dalton and get all of Third World Press. You know, it just didn't exist in that way.
Right.
And then, in some ways, it was poetic justice. The big bookstore, the big box bookstores, got eaten up by Target and Walmart.
Yeah.
And then they got eaten up by Amazon. And so suddenly, you can't even access real physical space of community and growth. And so what I wanted to do, when I had a little bit of money and some resources and some time, was to say, hey, I want to rebuild a space, not just where you can buy books, which is dope, but where we have physical black space where we can see each other and talk to each other and engage each other and have some level of safety, what we call counter publics. And that, for me, is incredibly important. And that's why I opened up Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books in Philadelphia. So people can buy books and they can get the best coffee in the city, I think, and some good sweet potato pie and all that. That's all dope. But more importantly, you know, we're doing a Palestine teaching in May. Pam Africa and the folk from MOVE are coming today, and we're doing a Mumia book signing, you know, on his behalf next month. You know, we do free films to the community. We do reading groups. I do children's story time every Tuesday morning. All this is free to the community. The films are free. The movies are free. We had a Martin Luther King Day symposium. We got a Malcolm X symposium coming up in May. All free to the community. The goal is to create space in the community, and a hub in the community where people can grow and people can build and people can organize and people can be safe. And that for me is the most important part of opening this space. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to stand in the tradition of folk who have done this. And I'm not doing it as well as they do, but hopefully I'll make some new mistakes, but learn from everything that's happened in this tradition. And, and I'm so grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're doing that as well. Where can folks reach out to you personally, and also let folks know how they can drop by if they're in Philadelphia listening to this, or if they just traveling through? Where's the bookstore? Where they can come and get this coffee and read and hang out and talk and commune with one another, but also how can folks reach you?
So they can reach me through my website, Mark Lamont Hill. All my contact info and stuff, whether it's for speaking, whether it's just to find out what I'm writing and thinking about, you can hit me at marklamonthill.com. And Uncle Bobby's has a website, and you can find out about all of our events. You can find out about our story, and you can find out our location, which is in Germantown, right by going to unclebobbies.com. And Uncle Bobby's is Bobby's is B-O-B-B-I-E-S. So Uncle B-O-B-B-I-E-S.com. You can check me out there, man, and just stay tuned, because so much dope stuff happening. I'm just glad to be part of this moment.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show, and look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Gene Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.